This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, December 4th, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Poetry North and Poetry South. If we think our politics are too partisan, our country too divided, we only need to go to our local Cineplex to watch Lincoln and be reminded that Americans used to kill each other by the tens of thousands. A lot has changed since then, including the place of poetry and other forms of rhetoric in public life. According to Faith Barrett, during the Civil War, poetry didn't just respond to events, it also helped shape them. And she has written a book about it called To Fight Aloud is Very Brave. Faith Barrett is a professor of English at Lawrence University, and she joins me from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Faith, there's a print interview with you up on our website, poetryfoundation.org, and I'm going to steal the first question from it that the writer Ruth Graham posed to you, and I'm going to ask it again here. You write that the Civil War was a poetry-fueled war. What do you mean by that?
I think the cultural position of poetry in 19th century America is so different than it is today that it's difficult for us in some ways to imagine how crucial a role poetry plays in the events of the war. Poetry is appearing in newspapers. Poems are sung and recited at send-offs for soldiers. They're sung and recited in the military hospitals. So poetry is woven into the fabric of everyday American life in the Civil War era.
But to call it poetry-fueled suggests that poetry is providing the timber for what became an incredibly destructive war. That's really something.
Well, I can give you a specific example. When Lincoln calls for another round of the draft in the North, what was called conscription, James Sloan Gibbons writes a poem called We Are Coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 More. And then the story goes that he actually sings this for Lincoln in his office. So there's a very quick and close relationship then between the war's events and poets' responses. Stories of soldiers dying with poems in their breast pockets, poems on their lips. These kinds of stories abound during this era. And for these reasons, I argue that it's not just responding to, but in fact, helping to shape events as they take place.
Now, your book focuses mostly on poetry written in the North, but it also touches on poetry written in the South. And it occurs to me that I have never read a poem, consciously read a poem by a pro-Confederacy poet. And you have one to read by Henry Timrod, known as the Poet Laureate of the Confederacy. Can you tell us a little bit about him and the poem you're going to read?
Sure. Timrod was a kind of up-and-coming young poet in the years running up to the war. He dies not long after the war, like many Southerners, struggles with poverty and displacement in the aftermath of the war. So died at a fairly young age, but wrote quite a few poems that became sort of centerpieces of Confederate ideology during the war.
Now, the poem you've chosen is called The Unknown Dead. And the dead he's talking about, are they Confederate dead or are they Northern dead, or is it just not clear?
Yeah, The Unknown Dead is an elegy for the Southern dead. And what's interesting about this elegy in particular is that it focuses not on the deaths of heroes and leaders, but it's really focused on the death of the common soldier. But pretty clearly, because of its tone and its implicit celebration of the South, focusing just on this, celebrating the Southern dead.
Great. Let's hear it. Here's The Unknown Dead by Henry Timrod.
The rain is plashing on my sill, but all the winds of heaven are still. And so it falls with that dull sound which thrills us in the churchyard ground, when the first spadeful drops like lead upon the coffin of the dead. Beyond my streaming window pane, I cannot see the neighboring vane, yet from its old familiar tower, the bell comes muffled through the shower. What strange and unsuspected link of feeling touched has made me think, while with a vacant soul and eye I watch that gray and stony sky, of nameless graves on battle plains, washed by a single winter's rains, where some beneath Virginian hills and some by green Atlantic rills, some by the waters of the west, a myriad unknown heroes rest. Ah, not the chiefs who, dying, see their flags in front of victory, or at their lifeblood's noble cost, pay for a battle nobly lost, claim from their monumental beds the bitterest tears a nation sheds. Beneath yon lonely mound, the spot by all save some fond few forgot, lie the true martyrs of the fight, which strikes for freedom and for right. Of them their patriot zeal and pride, the lofty faith that with them died, no grateful page shall farther tell than that so many bravely fell. And we can only dimly guess what worlds of all this world's distress, what utter woe, despair, and dearth their fate has brought to many a hearth. Just such a sky as this should weep above them, always where they sleep. Yet haply at this very hour, their graves are like a lover's bower, and nature's self, with eyes unwet, oblivious of the crimson debt to which she owes her April grace, laughs gaily o'er their burial place.
That was The Unknown Dead by Henry Timrod. Now, the rhyme couplets are really skillfully done. It's a very, obviously a very polished and skillful poem. Was this written during the war, after the war? When was it written?
This first appeared in the Southern Illustrated News, July 4th, 1863, so right in the midst of the Battle of Gettysburg. 1863, of course, historians now see as a kind of turning point in the war. So this is a poem where Timrod is meditating at length on the fate of common soldiers and the freedoms for which they believed they were fighting.
He sees the Southern soldiers as true martyrs for the fight, which strikes for freedom and for right.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real Southern point of view that we get in this poem. But it's a more ambitious poem. It's not a piece of political agitprop. He's trying to write a more ambitious poem about the indifference of nature to human suffering.
Yeah, and certainly Timrod at other times during the war does write poems that are just straight up calls to arms for the Confederate Army. He writes poems that are kind of announcing the birth of a new nation and its glorious entrance onto the stage of world history. So this is one that is in many ways more sophisticated in its political and aesthetic aims than some of the other wartime pieces that he wrote.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul goes marching on.
We're listening to Paul Robeson's version of John Brown's Body, the great abolitionist song. Now, Faith, during the Civil War, Julia Ward Howe used that melody and the cadence of the lyrics to write Battle Hymn of the Republic. Tell us a little bit about Julia Ward Howe and how she came to write one of the most popular poems for the Civil War.
Sure, yeah. So Julia Ward Howe had traveled with her husband and a group of friends down to Washington, D.C. in the fall of 1861. They had made a plan to go out to see a review of Union troops, and that plan then had to be canceled when Confederate forces got too close to the Union line. So she and a group of her friends were riding in a carriage back into Washington, D.C., and kind of got stuck in columns of Union soldiers, so they're moving very slowly. They start singing John Brown's Body. The soldiers around them are cheering. Samuel Freeman Clark, who's in the carriage with Howe, says, you should write some better words for that lovely tune. Howe went to sleep that night in the Willard Hotel, woke up early next morning, and the words of the song just came to her, and she got up and kind of scrawled them in the dim light. She sends the poem off to the Atlantic Monthly, and they publish it in their premier issue, which is February of 1862, in a kind of prominent leading position. But within a month or two, it's circulating in song sheet format. It's being sung by Union soldiers. So it has a very quick popular reach as well, and becomes one of the most popular songs in the North during the war years.
And it still is popular, and there are hundreds of recordings of Battle Hymn of the Republic. And the melody is really quite lovely, so lovely that, in fact, I think it kind of overshadows the words in a way which are astonishing to me. This is the first time preparing for this interview that I've actually read the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and I'm quite shocked by it. So can I get you to read the poem dry, without music, as it were? And listeners can, of course, hum along as they as they hear the words.
Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible, swift sword. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. I have read a fiery gospel writ in burnished rows of steel. As ye deal with my contemners, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel, since God is marching on. He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. O, be swift, my soul, to answer him, be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on.
That was Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe. And I have to say, the ideas expressed here really are appalling to me. It's basically saying that killing and getting killed for the Republic, for the North, is okay with God. God is on our side. It's a holy war.
Yeah, no, this is a poem that speaks a call for blood vengeance and that argues in imagery that's very compelling, I think, that God is on the side of the North. And I do think disturbingly that this is one reason this song has a kind of cultural staying power in the U.S., and that is that these arguments that God is on our side, whatever our side might mean given a particular conflict, those arguments have a very strong pull, I think, in American culture.
Yeah, talk about how that song and those words to that song are used today. They come up frequently.
Yeah, this was an anthem that was sung frequently, for example, in the aftermath of 9/11. Mm. It's striking to me that what Howe's song is about is the division of the nation, and yet we now use it paradoxically as a statement of national unity.
Chilling to me. I mean, I have to say, I'm chilled by it. We hear the same arguments from jihadists in Muslim countries that we can go and kill people because God is on our side.
Yeah, and what happens over the course of the song, the lyrics, of course, begin with pronouns in the singular. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. That's a singular speaker saying that he, she has had a one-on-one vision of the Lord and the glory of the Lord. This is Christ's second coming, right? Christ coming down and intervening in the civil war. But by the end of the poem, by the last verse, we have a we that's being forged in that last stanza. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. So the singular pronouns of the opening verses has now become a first-person plural, let us die to make men free. And of course, nowadays we interpret the song as being largely about abolition, but the point at which Howe wrote the song and the point at which she wrote these lyrics and the point at which it was being sung by Union soldiers, there are lots of Union soldiers who don't think they're fighting in the war to abolish slavery, particularly before Lincoln's reelection. In the first couple of years of the war, an awful lot of Union soldiers are joining up to preserve the Union, but not to abolish slavery. And I think compared to the song that preceded this one, John Brown's Body, Howe's references to slavery are more oblique. Let us die to make men free, I'm sure, meant a lot of different things to different listeners and singers in the Civil War. And of course, both sides, North and South, argue that they're fighting to defend freedoms that have been lost since the American Revolution.
Now we have time for one more poem, this one by the African-American slave George Moses Horton. Tell us a little bit about him and the poem you're going to read.
George Moses Horton, a man born into slavery in the South around 1800, really extraordinary and remarkable life story. He's born in North Carolina, and as a young man, he starts making regular trips to Chapel Hill, selling fruit, running errands for young white male students at the University of North Carolina. During that period in his life, he starts composing poems, love poems made to order for young white university students. And he's so good at this that he eventually is able to persuade his master to let him hire his own time as a slave. So Horton makes a living as an enslaved African-American by working as a poet in Chapel Hill for decades, and publishes two collections of poetry while enslaved. The Union Army, the 9th Michigan Cavalry, passes through Chapel Hill in North Carolina in the spring of 1865. And at that point, Horton leaves his plantation and travels. It's while he's on the march with the Michigan cavalry during those summer months that he writes many of the poems that he includes in his final collection. That collection is called Naked Genius, and I'm going to read one poem from it that's lamenting the devastation of the South in the aftermath of the war.
That's an amazing story. So go ahead and give his poem a read. Here's Weep by George Moses Horton.
Weep for the country in its present state, and of the gloom which still the future waits. The proud Confederate eagle heard the sound, and with her flight fell prostrate to the ground. Weep for the loss the country has sustained, by which her now dependent is in jail, the grief of him who now the war survived, the conscript husbands and the weeping wives. Weep for the seas of blood the battle cost, and souls that ever hope forever lost. The ravage of the field with no recruit, trees by the vengeance blasted to the root. Weep for the downfall o'er your heads and chief, who sunk without a medium of relief, who fell beneath the hatchet of their pride, then like the serpent bit themselves and died. Weep for the downfall of your president, who far too late his folly must repent, who like the dragon did all heaven assail, and dragged his friends to limbo with his tail. Weep o'er peculiar swelling coffers void, our treasures left and all their banks destroyed, their foundless notes replete with shame to all, expecting every day their final fall, in quest of profit never to be won, then sadly fallen and forever down.
That was Weep by George Moses Horton. It's a peculiar poem in one way because there's a note of triumph in it, but a great note of sorrow. That it's the more dominant note is this is terrible stuff that has happened, but these guys deserved it.
Yeah, and I think you see the mix of Horton's emotions as a black, formerly enslaved Southerner as he tries to reflect on the devastation of the country that he had effectively known as his home throughout his life, and that is the South, right? You see that ambivalence coming through, I think, in the pronoun shifts. He seems to accuse white Southerners in some places, right? Weep for the downfall or your heads in chief. Weep for the downfall of your president. There's a kind of undertone of accusation in that use of the pronoun you. And yet by the end of the poem, he's distanced himself a little bit from that directly accusatory you, and he's talking about the financial devastation. At this point, he's probably thinking about financial turmoil, both North and South, but particularly the financial devastation in the South. And here he shifts to the third person plural, but there's also a line where he's got the first person plural, our treasures left and all their banks destroyed. This opposition between our and their, I think, is not so much a true opposition as it is a reflection of his own shifting allegiances over the course of the poem between North and South.
Now, none of the poems we've heard are considered great literature on par with Walt Whitman, who wrote some wonderful poems about the Civil War, and even Emily Dickinson. Is your interest, or should our interest be more historical than literary, do you think?
I think this work warrants consideration on both counts. For one, I find the work politically fascinating. There's such a range of perspectives. There's such a great outpouring of this work that there's a great diversity of aesthetic perspectives and political perspectives as well across the whole spectrum of Civil War poetry. So I think the political content is deeply interesting. At the same time, I think we've sold this work short by arguing that it doesn't merit our attention aesthetically. I find a lot of aesthetic power in Horton's poems, even though it is clear that some of them, Weep in particular, was probably written while on the march, typographical errors, odd decisions in terms of the editing and so forth. But I think we do this work a disservice by arguing that it doesn't have the aesthetic power of, say, Whitman's and Dickinson's work. And one of the main argumentative investments of my book is to try to reposition Dickinson in particular in such a way that we don't single her out as one as a solitary genius from this era, but rather read her work as being deeply connected to the kinds of innovation, both aesthetic innovation and then also kind of political arguments that are being advanced in these poems.
Faith Barrett, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Faith Barrett's book about poetry during the Civil War is called To Fight Aloud is Very Brave. There's a print interview with her on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can find all the poems you just heard and thousands of others. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.